Thank you much. Good to see a bunch of familiar faces. And I guess we'll get started. I will start with the same disclaimer that I always, that my lawyers make me put up all the time. Please don't trade off this, run investment advice or anything else. So with that, more or less, I don't know what I'm talking about going forward. So I can tell you, if I'm the chief ag economist at DuPont Pioneer, obviously I don't know how to make money off market data either. Otherwise, I'd be living on an island someplace. So please don't trade off of this information. I am going to start by talking about the macro. What's the drivers in macro? Because the questions I got, I actually went to leadership conference. I've done that in the past. We went to Leadership Institute this year because I happened to be in New York, and then I had to go up to Wilmington, Delaware. So I stopped by Washington and did that. And I got a lot of questions at the Leadership Institute this year. Is this going to be sustainable? What's going to happen? What do we need to do going forward? So what I did here is I tried to answer those questions. And it's a complicated issue, and you'll hear more parts of it today from others. But I'm going to start and talk to you about what are the drivers of demand, and can it drive up? And what are drivers of supply, and is this a supply-driven market issue or demand-driven? But really, if you think about your time through your careers, prices really have not moved. They only move up and stay at a higher level when it's demand-driven. They drove up in 2006 is what really when we started to set this new mark, and it was not only because of ethanol, it was also because crude oil jumped. Crude oil in the 1990s averaged $19.09. So it was crude oil plus, then they responded to it with policies. That's when he drove price up. From 1970, give or take, to 2006, corn averaged $2.26. Before that was World War II. We averaged $1.25 from World War II to 1970. Before that, it was World War I. So there's these episodic issues that are demand-driven that are going to drive the market. So people ask me, is this going to continue? I'll tell you about the demand. I'll tell you the demand is solid, but I'll also tell you this is a supply-driven issue and expect the markets to go down. You know, the sign of a good ag economist is that it throws cold water on bad ideas. And that's what I'm trying to do right now. I'm a pessimist by nature, so we'll go with it from there. So here's population. You always hear this about the UN, where the population's going to be, where it's going to drive the next by 2050. And it, as you can see out there, they think that we're going to have a lot of high population, but it's going to come in the low-income areas. That's what you need to know. Okay, that's the general thing for the demand-driven drivers, and you can see by the countries where they think it's going to drive, where it's going to drive in the low income, and that's broken out in the bottom part of that graph. Population density in the world, where are those people living? As you can see, the yellows and the oranges is where those people, where we're going to drive it, and they also currently have lower income. You have three big sources of supply to the world market that are exporters. And that's North America, South America, and Ukraine, Black Sea regions coming on. The rest of the world either is self-sufficient or imports to a great extent. So you can see where they need the food, and you can see where they're at a deficit. So is the U.S., are we going to be able to capture that? What's it look like going forward? I'm the ag economist in the DuPont Economist Office. And people ask how many ag economists there are or economists. Please don't let your kids become economists because supply and demand works. There's only three of us in all of DuPont that we have 70,000 employees. I have other people that report to me. Many of you have seen Virg Robinson does market to market. He reports up through me. Tom Reynolds, who used to be at John Deere, and Chris Taylor. I have three that report to me, but there's really only three corporate economists. So please don't let your kids become economists. We don't need any more, to be honest with you. So here's what we're saying. We have been the closest on the blue chips of forecasting. We're the only ones that have ever won it three times on forecasting what it's going to be. But I want to show you that we show that growth in 2013 is going to be less. I don't care what president gets reelected. I don't care how the House and Senate fall. We have it going down. But keep your eye on the 1.6%. We'll come back to that for the North America. When you talk about percentages and GDPs, it's hard to get a point on what the percentages are, what they mean on level terms. As you can see, this is dollars per person per year. We are, and somebody asked me, are we better off than we were 4 years ago? You can see this. This is not a political comment. We have people in work, out of work, but on average, on a per cap basis, we are less than we were. The world, though, has recovered and come back up. So what are the dynamics? What is happening? How do we get food growth? Because we talk about population and what is the income that will drive this eating more food. If you can see up here, we still have a lot of people that are hungry, very hungry. And they don't even get the 1,800 calories per day because they make less than $1.25. The big growth, though, is from $2 to $10. That's when people's diets change. That's when we see more demand for the products that we produce on the land here in the U.S. And that goes from $730 to about $4,000 per person. And then above that, we eat more luxury food and everything else. So you say, well, that's nice, hypothetical. Can you show me an example? So I'll try to show you an example. China, everybody talks about them slowing down, and they're slowing down a percent. We're not growing at 10%. Everybody's worried about China only growing 6 or 7%. But I had a very good professor at the University of Nebraska, Dr. Morris Baker, and he told me, don't worry about level. You got to also, you know, the percent. You got to worry about the level number. And if you guys don't know him, I got educated by my parents, were my best educators, and the second best was Dr. Baker at the University of Nebraska. He's sitting right back there. He's actually the secretary of Nebraska's chapter, and he's been here forever. So if you see anything you don't like about this, blame my professor, please, and give him the shots. But if you look at it, while they're growing, and they're growing at a lower rate, the level is actually increasing in China. They are changing their diets, and you can see that on the right on the right-hand side of that. Per pounds per person is going up, and it's going right through that sweet spot that we talked about, the demand. So did they really change their diets? Did they change what they're doing? If you look in aggregate, they had half the pork in the world, half the pigs in the world do speak Chinese, and as you can see that, it's still going up. They have also driven, because they can't produce them in their out back behind, they have now more industrialized agriculture. And as you can see, because of that, they change their feed rations, and they are having more corn and meal, both. So that's a big demand for the Midwest agriculture of the U.S. How does it relate to the world? As you can see, world, again, this is changing diets. People eat more meat, and we'd have more demand for corn and soybeans. Wheat and rice, pounds per person, have not changed all the way back to 1996. This is not just because of ethanol that this growth has happened, like contrary to some of the things you see in the press. It is because people are eating more meat, and as you can see, what they're eating more is chicken and pork on a global basis. Beef had its Atkins run that kept them in, but price does matter. The world economy did slow down, and beef has actually decreased globally since that time. So how does it relate to the ending stocks and what our crops are, and how do we pull it back into what the world is looking like, and why we have this price volatility and price spikes is because we have low ending stocks. We had ending stocks that were really low for corn, for wheat, and for rice. They have dropped, and as you can see, longer term, they're dropped. Now, the question that I always get is, what about soybeans? Why does this go up? This is an accounting issue, is what soybeans, why it looks like we're building stocks, is because the USDA calculates this in September, right? Well, at the time that this was in 1992, the U.S. produced 51% of the soybeans in the world. Now we produce 29%. Back then, in 1992, South America produced 30% of the soybeans in the world and now produce 55%. So when they do it September 1st, they're harvesting. They got a big harvest. That's why soybean, if you look at a stocks-to-use ratio, is not indicative of how tight the market is. And we'll talk about where that supply goes very shortly. So what happened this year? We had the nice slides up here earlier in the session before. And this is how USDA calculates that we actually do this weekly from the USDA data. And we started pulling it down. We pulled our yields down starting in April. We thought we forecast yields, of course, internally. We started pulling them down in April. USDA, because I'm on the CBO, they talked to me and they said, what are you doing with yields? And I said, I'm pulling them down. And then USDA, in their wisdom in May, went up on their yields because of early planting. And then I asked them the question, why did you go up because of early planting? And they said, because usually in early planting, we get better yields. And I said, well, you got to look at the reason why we had early planting is because it was dry. So if you assume normal weather from here on out, it's still going to be dry. Now, I didn't pull them down to the degree they came today, but they assume a different thing. USDA, when you look at their reports, they assume that we are going to have normal weather. Not normal weather from here on out. So when they forecast your trend yields that you will see next January, February at their Outlook conference, they will have a trend. And they will trend and put a yield number out there that will move the markets, but it is based off of a normal weather year. Not normal weather from here on out and making up for the deficit. There's a lot of difference if somebody loses their job and blows through their savings account, and then you give them a job, then they come back on, compared to if you have a big savings account and then you keep getting checks. There's a lot difference when you look at that, and there's a lot difference when you look at weather. So when you see the USDA numbers next year in the forecast and some other people that will forecast it, like in Memphis, Tennessee, and other places like that, just know what and figure out what that assumption is, because it makes a big difference given that we have low carryover stocks. So how did it impact the world? In May, the USDA, and these are stocks to use ratio, and I personally hate the small column, and that's why I put it in small little print there, is because I always get asked by media and others, how many days of carryover we have left? Well, as an economist, that just turns me, because we are never going to run out of a crop, but the last bushel is going to be dadgum expensive, okay? So they assume that you're going to run out of the crop at the end of the year. Well, that's not the case. But you'll see that in the media a lot, how many days of carryover. So I put it up there, and all they do is take the percentage times 365 days. But as you can see, we did not drive corn down as much as some people think. It's only at 14% stocks-to-use ratio. And you look at how much they've decreased over time. Well, what's interesting about that will tell you why that could be the case. When you look at production and what world crop production was, if you see that line down there that I have highlighted for 2012, they expected that we were going to have records in corn by a huge amount. The former record was 877 million metric tons. Currently, they said we're going to go to 945. It would have been a huge crop, a huge crop. That's when USDA came out with a 460 corn price, okay? If you look at that, we still produced, see the black bar, we still produced the second largest crop in the history of the world this year in corn. Highest production in cotton, seventh, because we didn't get the acres also. Soybeans was second highest, rice first, wheat was fourth, and sugar, which matters for our ethanol and for our corn balance sheet, is the biggest crop that we've ever had. So we still had a big crop this year, and we have these high prices. Can they be sustained? That's a question that I think you'll need to ask yourself and ask, you know, talk to your customers through it. But there's looks at the impact of the global drought and what USDA says the drought was. Why do we need this high production? Is because, as you can see, this is cereals. This is not oil seeds. But its cereals includes wheat, milled rice, sorghum, barley, oats, millet, rye, and mixed grains, also corn, of course. And as you can see, we're consuming more and more. We're feeding the world, and we are having to produce more and more grains. And that's including, you know, that people are not eating as much wheat and rice. It's the same per cap usage. But this is why we need the big production. We need this ongoing. That's why it is a true demand story long term. It's just, is the U.S. set up for this? And don't get yourself fooled into thinking that we are going to have $7 corn price all the way out. We'll talk about that. So this is the positive spin. Then we'll talk about the negative spin, or try to get us back to a realistic picture. As you can see, here's corn yields, and here's what the corn yields are. Top is U.S. yields, what happened this year. Here's the rest of the world. Didn't really have a blip. As you can see, continues to trend up about 1% per year, because that's what seeding rate goes up, about 1% per year globally. So that's what it comes down to. You still put one ear per plant mostly. So how do you get there? You just got a seeding rate. So as you can see, there's the growth. And there's soybeans. Our soybean yield right now is supposed to be back to the world average. So that's how bad soybean was this past year. So I know I was standing back there for earlier presentations. This is a lot to look at, especially back there. But I wanted to show you a couple things. The blue area, you see the price was $4.60 a bushel, is what USDA said was going to happen. And 166 bushels an acre was their trend. They came out in their trend in February as 164. So they upped it 2 bushels an acre, drove it to $4.60 a bushel. As you can see, currently we're at 780 and 122 bushels an acre. But don't discount what's in the blue, because USDA may come out something similar to that in February. As we plant another 97 million acres, they might have a $5 price or less, because you will build stocks in that situation. And there's soybeans. Soybeans, a similar story. We do not think that USDA is done with yields yet. We think they'll come, they should move them a little bit. In November 9th, next Friday, and then they'll adjust them finally in January. So, but why were the prices amplified? Because it happened late, because some livestock producers and users thought we could get through. We're going to see lower prices coming on out, so they didn't hedge as much. A lot of them, especially the poultry, got in that situation. Prices went up. They couldn't buy into the window. It was a tight window, and they got caught with those high prices because they thought it was going to be $4.60 farm price by harvest. And they thought even with meal, they could make it up with the corn on their feed rations, and they got caught. We started getting a lot of calls to us, what do we think about yield, from the big poultry companies, the big beef and pork companies. In July, they said, what do you think about the agronomics, how this is going to be? So I know they got caught without any positions. They got caught naked, and that's the big issue. That's why prices drove up. So what is the world soybean situation? Again, I told you about the percentages earlier, but actually, when I was down in Argentina last year, right after this meeting, that's why I missed the Arizona meeting. I was in Argentina last year. They were already talking about the bad crop. They currently have it right now. Some of the information from USDA says that they're going to have a big crop and big rebound this year. I don't see that, especially in corn. We've had to replant. The farmers have replanted down there. So you can be down from USDA's corn number also for this year. But as you can see, they had their big bad crop this last year. We added a bad crop here this year. When you put those two together, that's what drove stocks up, down, and that's what drove price up. Here's, let's go to corn, and I'll kind of walk you through corn, because this is kind of, it used to be, everybody called, said corn was king, and there was a bunch of talks about how corn was king. Let's go through this real quick. We are at a low stocks to use ratio, the lowest since 1995. But remember, we had a set aside in 1995. We had a 7.5% set aside. We knew we were going to get those acres back in 96. So it still is a perceived tighter window right now than it was in 1995 going into 1996. And world stocks to use ratio is continually low. We have data back to 1960 on that. And if you can see that, we're back to the lows we were in the 70s. You know, we still had the seventh largest crop produced in the U.S. this year ever, and the second largest in the world, and this is the situation we're sitting on. Here's U.S. ending stocks, and as you can see, somebody asked me what's going to happen with acres. Here you go. Cotton's going to give up acres. Wheat is going to pull in more acres this year, both in soft red and hard red areas. So it's going to be hard for corn and beans to go out and get their acres. Different a little bit than last year. And as you can see, so there will be a big battle for the acres here this spring. And there's going to be a smaller pie. Because even with cotton going down, you know, from 12 to 10, that's only 2 million acres. Yes, you're going to get a little bit more because of the soft red. We're going to plant a little more double crop, which should help on the total pie, but really it's going to be a battle for acres this spring. It'll be interesting to see when all these privates come out and add them up. That's what I always like to do, add up, see how big their pie is, because we might have to plant some of the medians of the interstates across the country to get the acres that they're saying. The ones I saw out of Memphis this past week scared me to death. You can't do that math. I don't, you know, unless there is no CRP, and we know how fast that turns around. So it'll be interesting, and they're doing that to balance their, you know, to make their balance sheet work. But that's why some people, there was one person that I looked at had 98.5 million acres of corn, but they were running corn price after the next year into, it had a 380 on it is what their farm price was. Well, I don't think you're going to get that. You can't do it. You got to add up the pies. So please do when you go through, and if they have them all there, just calculate how big they think it's going to be. So there's ending stocks. There's what we, you know, it's easy to do acreage off of just looking at that ending stocks. So here's corn use. Let's get to corn use real quick and look at corn use. How am I doing on time? I'm okay. Stocks to use ratio, again, low in the U.S., same data. Exports, we pulled down. Feed use, historically low. Feed use, when we look at, yes, I know that USDA calls this a residual. They don't even like the name feed. Talk to Jerry Norton. He hates that because they back into that number. But if you look at that compared to how many animals are out there, which most people would just add the animals, they know kind of what the feed rations are and add them up, you think that's how they get feed use. They don't do that. They know the other categories. They know more or less what goes into ethanol. They knows what goes into HFCS and everything else. They know what goes into exports. Feed use is just whatever's left over from the production number that USDA NASS gives them. That's all it is. But if you look at that, we are right now lower. If you take a number of animals out there, we are the lowest that we've been in corn per animal unit, including DDGs, which I've calculated, even back to 1988 when we had the 88 drought. We are now lower than we are there. So it is tight. What it shows you also, though, is that we'll probably need more contraction in the livestock industry that we have not seen yet, because those animal numbers probably aren't sustainable. So you think about long term, where's the demand growth, and how are we going to sustain this demand growth? There is a supply issue. We have a livestock issue that will probably have to kill some more head, and I'll go through these categories. You have ethanol that's pretty flat, and you have exports. Well, U.S. Grains Council, And Tom Doerr thinks that China's going to open the deal and we're going to have another soybean situation. We're going to export it all to China and everything's going to be great. We'll see. I'll show you some slides here and you can make your own decision on that. So here's U.S. and world grain trade. Let's go with exports right away. Let's hit them in the eyes and see what it looks like. As you can see, U.S. exports have gone down. 2007, while everybody blamed ethanol, that was still a record high year for exports. And as you can see, we have gone down since that time. The world has gone up a little bit, and the Black Sea region is a major cause of that reason that it's gone up. But the right-hand slide is the one I wanted to show you guys, was the world share. Our share of the world's exports of corn has gone down and gone down quite dramatically. Are we going to get that back? That's the key. Are we in competitive to get it back? Do we have the locks and dams? Do we have the infrastructure to get back to feed this growing share in the world? We talked about where the growth was going to be. It's us. Our competitors are South America. We got North America. We got Black Sea. The growth, because of the diets and everything, is going to happen in Asia, Africa, and other places. How can we get our corn there to keep our industry strong here in the U.S.? We're losing right now, to be honest with you. That's just something to think about. So, what about domestic demand for livestock? As you can see, pounds per person per day of meat and dairy in the U.S. have gone down. And with the new changes in the school lunch program, it's projected that they're going to go down even more because kids are not getting the same food. It was kind of an interesting story. I have two children. Ellen and I, one's eight. Kyle is 10, and Kale is 8. And it's quite interesting. They were just livid about what they got in their school lunches. This time they've cut their chicken McNuggets in half, is what they've done. So they don't get that anymore. They have a vegetable or something every day during class. So instead of milk and graham crackers, and these are, you know, we did that we used to have at kindergarten or whatever, they give them vegetables. Well, they said the kids need an opportunity to eat it. Well, half the people have no idea. This week they gave them loose leaf spinach. Is what they gave them. So it is changing people's diet. But it was funny in the weekly reader poll, you know, that really checks the president's election, you know, and they're pretty good. I think they check third graders, and they've been pretty good. And living in a battleground state is pretty interesting. Somebody voted for Romney. This girl did. In inner city, I think it was inner city Chicago or something, she voted for Romney. And they said, "Why did you vote for Romney?" And she goes, "Because Mrs. Obama took my dessert off my school lunch menu." So I guess it shows that people vote for what hits home. And so it's just interesting. But it does show you that we're going to change people's diets. The next generation is going to eat less because we are changing what people have. They're drinking less milk. You just can't get milk. How many people are going to start drinking milk in college? When they get out of, you know, that's, so we are setting it longer term, and it could be for health, it's health reasons or whatever, but it's the demand for the products of corn and beans in domestically. That's the point I want to get across to all of you. It has gone down, and this will just continue to do it. Go to the next slide. So how can livestock be healthy, and how can we get the corn out of here? We have, you know, chicken has been the savior, and we have exported a lot. But really, we've kind of stagnated here since 2006 on exports out of the U.S. of chickens. So what about pork? Now, pork, we had the big run-up in 2008 because of the Olympics, because Chinese bought everything. They wanted everybody fed. But really, we've come back to that line. So we need the chicken exports. We need the pork exports. That's how we're getting the corn and the beans out of the Midwest. But what about beef? Beef, we had the mad cow on Christmas of 2003, which really dropped our exports. I remember I was at home getting ready to go to my folks', or my not my folks, it's my in-laws' house in Wisconsin. We were packing in 2003 at the end of the close of business on Christmas, and they said we had mad cow. And you see what the ramifications were in 2004 all the way out. We've rebuilt to that level. We actually were a net exporter, but now currently USDA is projecting that we'll probably be a net importer again of beef. What do we import? Our livestock industry here is set up for steaks and roasts. We only make so much hamburger. You know, that's just the nature of the species. Well, you know, we have a family farm in Nebraska, and I tell my family we need to raise more cattle that has more hamburger. But they don't think that's too smart. They just say, you're a dumb economist. Don't come and talk to me about what we do on our family farm. And with my mom and dad deceased, I have a vested interest in our family farm, but they still say, you know, just go away. But it shows you that we need to import. What we do is we import the lower cuts. We import because we eat a lot of hamburgers in the U.S., and that's what we import. So can we export? What's the exports look like? What's it look like long term? Here's what the livestock industry currently looks like in our forecast for 20 into 2013. As you can see, the green part is dollars per cow. We saw it going down this year. We're talking in Nebraska about how many cow-calf we keep because our pasture condition's terrible, to be honest with you. We sold a bunch this week because we're not going to be able to stock the same rate that we are. We made that decision last week. So we're stocking less. But as you can see, the hogs are going to have some trouble. And that shows that they're going to have liquidation. That's just what it is. So if you have a freezer, fill it up with meat because meat prices are going to go up. And then as you see dairy, variable costs are now getting dairy, even though milk prices are higher. It's still not a good situation for the livestock sector. So what's that mean for the corn and bean sector, and can we keep the high prices there? Yes, we've had world corn use go up. And as you can see, feed use has been the big driver. Food, seed, and industrial use has not gone up as much. There was the ethanol jump. But it's not all that ethanol is the driver. Ethanol is going to be flat, and we'll show you why. But don't think that the corn use is going to go down or flatten out. It's just going to grow at a slower rate. We didn't have that bump up. So if you think about it, was not a slope shift on that growth. We didn't go like this to food use. What we did is, or corn used, what we did is we really did an intercept shift, and now we're back to the same growth rate given population and income. So don't copy down the numbers, but here's the law. Here's how much we need to consume. Corn for ethanol, we need to have 15 billion gallons. That's what it says in the Renewable Fuel Standard. 2007. We'll find out on, is it February 14th? Or no, November 14th. So that's why I'm not going to forecast a bunch of acres and everything, because right now we not only are murky at the government level and the fiscal cliff, which we'll talk about, we're also murky on this. What they say, what the EPA says in that waiver, and what it is going forward is going to make a big difference on how the markets view it and everything else to what it sees going forward. Are we going to waive the renewable fuel standard? If we don't, what is said in the renewable fuel standard and what is in their release? That will be a big guiding factor in the markets and in acres for 2013. So here's the law. Here's what they're arguing about. But I come back to you and say the renewable fuel standard law doesn't matter as much as people think. What matters is here is how they set this up. And I've walked some of you through that, but I have not walked all of you through this. When USDA, or when they did the renewable fuel standard, USDA worked with them, and the DOE came up and said, we're going to be at 150 billion gallons of total fuel consumption by 2015. So how did they drive the 15 billion gallons of ethanol? They took 10% of it. That's complicated math. No econometrics. They took 10%. Why? Because that's E10. That's your inclusion rate. But as you can see from the DOE, and everybody gives us ag economists a hard time about not being able to project. Look at the Department of Energy, oil economists. That's the forecast. That's what it is going forward. We are going to consume. We're going to drive fewer miles, and we're going to consume less. So when you look at E10, the RFS is above that. So if we don't include it, we're in trouble. And as you can see, they've dropped 15 billion gallons from their forecast for 2013 from when the RFS was set, and it's continued to go down with the new CAFE standards and everything else. The ethanol industry has some issues going forward. So here is the full RFS and the red bars behind here. Here's what E10 is looking like. E10 would be we're producing more than that right now at the 10% inclusion rate. So some people say E15 is the answer. We're going to get to the answer. That's no problem. That's going to buy us till what? 2015. We have a conundrum here in their policies. They don't make sense. They conflict, to be honest with you. How this plays out is a big forecast or a big factor in the forecast for agriculture here in the U.S. And I threw up E20, and some of the people are saying we need to get to E30 because that's the only way they'll solve it. But I just wanted to show you this, that this is an issue out here that impacts our industry and our customer base. This is a big issue that cannot be overlooked. And it's not, don't think the RFS is there, that it's a slam dunk. We need to worry about the inclusion rates and how, and work with the, and agriculture will have to work with who? The auto industry and big oil to make this happen. Are we strong enough and lobby enough to do this, or is something else going to come off the tracks? So just something to think about. Don't lose sleep over it, but something to think about. Here's another issue. This global sugar supply, we had low sugar. We had high sugar prices because we had low sugar production, and sugar production went down, as you can see. Because of that, Caribbean raw sugar price went up, and so we did not import the ethanol because they didn't make it from Brazil into the U.S. We actually were able to export our excess ethanol that we produced here. We actually exported it to Europe. We actually exported it to Brazil last year. Well, they're not going to continue to do that, because the reason that sugar was down in Brazil, even though area was up, as you can see the blue line here, is because their yields were down. Some of you don't know about sugarcane. Sugarcane, the optimum life of the stand is 2.1 years. Think about it as alfalfa. You plant it, and it goes through, and then you harvest. It's about a four-year cycle, but the average is 2.1 years. Last year, it was at 3.1. When they had the economic crisis of 08, 09, they did not plant new plants. So their plantations went down, their yields went down. The last time that happened was when they had their own internal economic crisis after the 98, 99. They didn't plant when they had their internal economic crisis. And as you can see, they came back up in yield. So Brazil will come back online. And as you see this year, we had record sugar production this year. So will we have an export market for the ethanol to help it if we can't include it in the U.S.? Highly unlikely. It's a little different than the past year. And you can see that in the price, the ethanol price and the RBOB price. Ethanol is running below the RBOB price, what they mix it into. So because of that, it shows that we're going to have some issues. So we'll go into food price. What's our food prices look like? Why haven't people said we have these high prices? Why haven't the consumers gone crazy? Because it's different. The ones in 07, 08 were because of wheat and rice mainly that went right into that diet that was the developing diet is what it went into. And we also had crude oil price that went up $140. You know, you got packaging, you have transportation, you have other issues. So we have not had the big outcry yet about food prices because of those factors. Well, crude oil, we don't think that because the economics is not going to go back to 140 next year. But with livestock prices going up, with dairy prices going up, we think that we'll be above 4% next year for 2013. So we're going to have a slower economy of 1.6%, and we're going to have food prices go up probably 4%. So that's what we're looking at right now on food and the food sector. The world also hasn't screamed, and we haven't had these big riots, partially because we have not had world policies that are messed up. You know, in 2008 in Egypt, what they did is they fixed the price of bread. So everybody who got the price of bread was fixed. But the price of wheat moved on the world market, and they have a lot of feed wheat. So price of wheat went up, price of bread was fixed. What did the farmers do? Livestock farmers. They bought bread and fed it to their animals. So we didn't have policies like that this time that have had these food riots. And also prices in 2012 so far, because the first half of the year, remember, looked like it was going to have low prices, were actually lower. And we didn't come up with the prices till later on. We do show this in our forecast for 2013 that this will increase as meat will drive the prices higher. So how short-term is this short-term drought? Is it over? Yes, we had Isaac come through, and I talked to the people in Illinois, Indiana, and they said, yeah, it's dry, but it's not as dry, so we feel better. But as you can see, there's May, there's June, and there's July. Or there's October, the latest October one. So I got May, July, and October, the most current one. As you can see, we still have not gotten rid of the drought. It's actually pretty bad. And do we get out of a drought in 1 year? Not usually. It started in 2011, really, in Texas. And then we had it pretty bad in 2012. So what's 2013 hold? So let's give you some years to look at. Here's 1934, there's 1935, and there's 1936. You don't get out of a drought in 1 year. So when these people put out balance sheets and put out dollars and how much corn is going to be and how much beans, just know that we probably still have a lingering drought here. There's 54, 55, 56. My uncle, the only one of that generation that's left in my family, he came back from World War II occupational force and started farming about that time. So he always talks about 1954, 55, 56. So as you can see, there was a drought severity index at that time. It was a 3 year or more issue. You don't get out of it in 1 year. And here's the 80s. Yes, 88. Everybody talked about was bad, but 89 wasn't a lot better. So think about that when we think about prices and how prices will go and the forecast that you're seeing that's out there. Here is how long it's going to take. Here's what it's going to take to get out of the drought. And it's hard to see it in the back of the room, but the dark blue, which we don't have any on, it takes 15 more inches. So you have to get your annual moisture plus another 15 inches to be back to normal. The purple areas, you have to have a foot of rain plus normal. The red areas, 9 to 12 inches. So yes, you know, the Nebraskans were talking about you have pivots. We have pivots too, but we were talking about how much do we run the pivots to get the corn up. You can't grow corn on concrete. So, I mean, that's what you got to think about when you're talking about your mixes and what you're growing here. But that's what it's going to take, 9 to 12 inches. Above some places in Nebraska, what is it? The average goes from 20 to 36 inches in Nebraska to get you, when you start over there in the panhandle. I think it's 20 to 36, isn't it, Dr. Baker? About that time. So you got to add another 12 inches to get out of this drought. And what's that going to do with your cow-calves? What's that going to do with all of that issue? This is not done by any means. But the U.S. government will say We have record farm income, so we don't need to help farmers. Farmers are not, agriculture is not the one that's hurting, so we don't need to help you. You have record farm income, you got crops and livestock receipts and farm-related income that's all near records. Your farm income is high, so it's, we don't need to help agriculture. The rest of the economy needs to be helped more. So we're going to change the farm bill, as we all know. Here's the CBO scores, and I'm on the CBO committee. Everybody says if they don't act on the fiscal cliff and we have to take the budget, that more or less the sequestered budget the super committee came up with, what's going to happen to ag? Well, both the House and the Senate wrote bills that are actually under that. So either way, if we get a farm bill, one of these, or we fail to act, and that actually happens, this is what we're going to lose. Now, you look at the bottom line and you say, then they said there's a lot of difference between the House and the Senate. We have actually a church, a member of our church is Tom Latham, goes to church with us, and we talked about this, and he said, I hate people talking about the 23 and how much the Senate is lower than everybody else. He said, break it out. Please break it out when you're presenting it by what we're looking at and, you know, what the total would be. And as you can see, the biggest change is what? Nutrition. All the rest of them are right on the same. And as you can see where they're going to cut it out of, they're going to cut, you know, $14 billion out of the commodity programs and then on down the line. So we do have a fiscal cliff, and I'm sure our next speaker will talk may talk a little bit about this, but here's what we're looking at. Remember, we said 1.6% GDP growth is what we said at the beginning of this. If you take all these, if they actually act in 4 weeks, the lame duck session is only 4 weeks this year. It's not six because the election falls and how Christmas falls, it's 4 weeks. They got to get a farm bill done and they got to handle all these. And it will matter if you flip one or the other houses, if you flip the Senate. It matters if Obama wins both the popular vote and electoral vote, or he just wins the electoral vote, or he flips completely. You'll have brinksmanship, you'll have everything else, posturing. You got to get it done in 4 weeks to handle these issues. But you're looking at this impact that is about 3%, and we're saying that the economy is only going to grow by 1.6. So that's why it's hard to forecast next year and everything else, because we have policy issues out there. You know, somebody made the comment, and I thought it was a good analogy. It's like driving in the fog with your headlights off. That's where we're at right now. That's why it's tough to forecast. So do we need to handle it? Should we not do this fiscal? Do we not do this and keep the economy going at 1.6%? What does that mean? Why do we have to worry about it? As you can see, the receipts that we had in 2012, FY 2012, by the CBO was $2.45 trillion. Okay? So the bar on the receipts and the outlays is interesting, but when you take out the sum of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, defense, and interest, it almost gobbles it up. That means everything else that the government does cannot be paid for by these mandatory programs. Something has to be done. And as interest rates, if Bernanke and his group has the interest rates go up, you're going to eclipse it. Those are going to eclipse what's going to happen. That's another huge cost to the government. So that's why they have to do something. And we'll see how nimble policymakers are. If they don't do anything, the alternative fiscal scenario is where we will be. That's the federal debt held by the public all the way back. As you can see there, you have the first Gulf War, and then you have World War II, you have World War I, you have the Civil War. So that gives you an idea. Even if they do pull all those things down and take out the 3%, we're still not going to get down to where we were historically. We are still going to be at a level that's only surpassed by World War II. That's why something needs to be done. That's why when we talk about farm prices, where we're going to be at 460 or whatever, when our costs have gone up, it's going to be hard to get a double AMPTA like we did in 2000. There's not a budget surplus out there. So with that, final thoughts. The fundamentals that are driving ag are strong. Population income growth, growing demand for our products. But don't expect this price wave to stay there. Ethanol is limited growth right now and has some headwinds. Global grain and oilseed production is expanding, and we're going to have competition. But we do currently have extremely tight stocks for corn and beans. We need a big crop this year, both here and in South America. If we don't, we will have more demand destruction longer term. You're going to have to. Right now, they're penciling in that they're going to get a big crop. If we don't have it, and we saw those droughts, remember how they go. It's not a one-year deal. You would have even more demand destruction. And we're going to have livestock rationing, to be honest with you. The current political environment has eroded business and consumer confidence. People are not investing. When you talk to the, when you see what the Fortune 500 companies are doing, and you talk to their, you see what their CEOs, they have roundtables, they're not investing because they don't have a clear picture. If it's a one-year deal every year, they don't have a clear picture. Until we do that, it's hard to grow the economy out of this. I'm not blaming Republicans, not blaming Democrats. I'm blaming them both. They got to get together in the Congress and get together and figure something out. It's not the president that makes this policy. It's the Congress, and we can't get together on it. And there's no room for any economic, monetary, trade mistakes. While we do live in the best country in the world, I feel, I travel all over the world, when's a policymaker been that nimble? So we're going to have high commodity prices, volatility, but the price level may not be there, because we're going to be dependent on the next 2 years. So how you invest in this and how you deal with your customers is a big issue going forward.